Okay, so we'll get started again. So, we saw with our event-based simulator, we had sort of the core data structure was our future event list, and then we had to take a number of actions based on examining this event list. We advanced time, and we determined what elements needed to be added to this list. Okay. And so, as I said a few minutes ago, what we're going to do now is have a little look at the structure of this list, and then we're going to have a look at how we deal with time, not in the sense of examining it and advancing it, but how do we choose time randomly. I was assuming that my laptop will work in any way. Okay. So what is this event list? It's a list of future events ordered according to time of occurrence. And you know, the purpose of ordering the list is naturally so you can find out which one happens next. Okay. And so you're going to need to be able to do a number of basic operations on this list. And again, don't worry overly much about it. We're again going through background, but if you use Java, this is fairly straightforward. You need to remove events from the top of the list. So the next event is the first on the list, if it's an ordered list. You need to add events into the list in an ordered fashion, again, examining the current event, the one you removed from the list. And potentially, although we don't do too much with this, but potentially you might also have to deschedule events from the list. Something might occur that means that something else won't happen in the future. You start the car rolling towards the cliff. It falls off the cliff unless you put on the brake. Okay. So if put on brake occurs before fall off cliff, you deschedule fall off cliff. Okay. So one issue with event lists is that they can be of arbitrary length. Because of the uncertainty in the system, you can't predict the size of, you can't necessarily predict the size of your list at the start. Okay. The characteristics presented by this type of a list suggest that one of the easiest ways to implement this list would be using what's called a linked list. So hands up if you've seen linked lists before. Very good. Okay, so I'm going to tell you what a linked list is. again, if you use Java, you probably don't need to get into too many gory details about it, but you need to understand the basic structure of it. Okay, so what a linked list is, it's a way of implementing a list structure without having to physically order the elements of the list. So you could say, well, why not just allocate an array? And the ordering in the array gives you the order of the list. Okay. So in that case, the physical positioning of elements of the list is significant. Well, the problems with that are, if you have an arbitrary length, how long do you make your array? You don't want to spill over. And this also, the physical positioning will also create problems in ordering lists. So if you think of this as being an array, you want to insert something into the middle. Well, you're going to have to physically move all the elements sort of below where you want to do the insertion. So needing to know physical positioning is problematic. Okay. So what we want is to decouple the storage issue from the ordering or the association issue. Okay. So now we want to think of our names as sort of being anywhere. The elements of our list are somewhere. Then we don't have the storage issue, but we also don't have any sort of relationship issue. So we need to add some information to indicate the relationship of these elements. And furthermore, we might want a very specific ordering of these elements. Okay, so how do we do this? Well, we have an indication of where the list starts. And then we have an indication of the sequencing in the list. So we go from, we start with Albert, then we go to Fred, to Jane, to Tim. Okay. And so if you're back in the Sea World, which is my favorite place, but those arrows are what we call pointers, and they give the physical address of all of these elements. If you're in the Java world, they're iterators, and you make queries on the iterators. Okay, and pretty much in C you have to do things yourself. In Java, it's all done for you. But what we have now, with or without ever, is we've got a collection of data and a way of indicating the relationship of that data. Okay, so we need to indicate the starting point, and then we need to indicate the sequencing on the data. Okay. And those two elements together are what we refer to as a linked list. And so obviously the arrows provide the links for the list. Okay. Okay, so what are the main benefits of linked lists? We can dynamically allocate the space for the components. So before, when we had our array, we had pre-allocated a fixed amount of space. Now we can add space as it's needed. And ordering now has to be accomplished by insertion into the list, okay? And the benefit is, again, you aren't relying on a specific physical location being available to put your piece of data in. You put it where it needs to go, and then you change these links. Okay. And so, again, if we just look at changing links, we have our initial list. We want to put new node in after old node. So we have to make it so somehow old node points to new node points to what old node previously pointed to. Again, if you were doing it in C, you might need to code that up yourself. If you're doing it in Java, you won't. What is true, though, is that if we're ordering a list and the order depends on the actual data values in the list, well, we're going to have to search the list to determine where to put the data. So, and that search can take sort of a random amount of time. If you're going to put the data here, well, you stop the search here. If you're going to put it at the end, well, you've got to go through the whole list to find the end. Okay. So that's a drawback of using this sort of representation. Okay. I mentioned deleting. And so deleting, again, is just a matter of changing how which elements point to which elements. And again, if you're in C, you'll have to deallocate the space that you used for that element. Okay. In order to find the node you want to delete, you'll have to do a search through the list. Okay. So, if we think of our event list, well, it's an event plus a time of occurrence of the event, and so the ordering that we're going to be aiming for is the a time ordering, and again, it's pretty clear that this will give us that ordering. Well, we can produce a list of that sort using linked lists. The plus of having the ordered list, again, will be that when we go to look for the next event to occur, we just have to examine the head of the list. Okay, so this is just a data structure. It's a way of representing lists It's not the only possible way, but again, because of the characteristics of our lists, in particular the arbitrary length of our list and the fact that we want to order it, it's not a bad way to do it. Okay. Java provides a class to handle linked lists. What it specifically doesn't allow you to do is to access pointers. So you can't get into the trouble you could get into if you did in C. And our methods provide add and remove from either the beginning or the end of the list. If you want access to other portions in the list, you need to use what's called a list iterator type. Okay. And I've provided a reference here for describing how linked lists work specifically in Java. Or again, you can use the Java. Yeah. Data as well. Okay. So there's nothing terribly deep about that. Again, if you haven't seen linked lists before, it might take, sitting down and thinking about exactly how the list is constructed. Again, a lot of it gets a bit masked in Java, so it might not be that complicated anyway. You'll just have an ordered list that you have to search through. Okay. Now, the list is not... A list of this sort is not necessarily the most efficient way to provide ordering. Again, the problem is that you have to traverse an arbitrary length of the list to insert or find a specific element. So if you want to insert an event occurring at time 2, well, you're going a short way into the list. If you want to insert an event happening at time 20, you're traversing nearly the whole list to be able to do that. Okay. For our purposes, in your simulations, the lists aren't going to get wildly long. So this works fine. Okay. If, the longer the list, again, the longer this sort of an operation is going to take. And so it's possible to use other structures to produce the ordered event list that will allow you to do this ordering faster. And Paris describes the use of heap structures in an appendix of his document. But again, for you guys and for what you're going to do, a linked list will work just fine. Okay, so this brings us on to our last topic of the day, which is generating random variates. And so, again, we've noted that our clock values, or the time values in our simulation, might be governed by random distributions. And yet, when we do our simulation, we're going to have to pick one value And when I say we pick one value, we pick one value at a time. As we go through our simulation, we'll return to that and pick another and another and another potentially. Okay. And what we want to ensure then is that as we pick another and another and another, that these values that we pick look sort of like what we'd expect if they'd truly been randomly generated. Okay. And so producing something of this sort typically consists of two steps. The first thing we try to do is to produce numbers that look like they're generated according to a uniform distribution, again, typically between 0 and 1. Okay. What does it mean to look like that? Well, we'll again, three lectures hence, or the third, three lectures for me hence, we'll talk about sort of how or whether we can convince ourselves that these things are sufficiently random or look sufficiently random. But typically, we look at the sequence of generated numbers and see if it has some characteristics that we'd expect if they truly were genuinely random. Okay. And at the very least, we would like it to be non-repeating for some arbitrary desired length. Once we have these pseudo-random numbers, this sequence that in some way looks like it's drawn from just a normal uniform 0-1 distribution, then we can use those numbers to generate sequences that look like they're drawn from more complicated distributions. Okay. And the main technique we're going to look at is the inverse transform technique, but then we'll look at for other tricks that can be used to generate other types of variables as well. Okay. So a pseudo-random number sequence is a sequence of numbers that adheres to a uniform random distribution. And when that distribution is uniform between 0 and 1, we refer to those as just random numbers. Okay, so if you have a random number generator, it should be generating some sequence of numbers between 0 and 1, which, again, hopefully look like they have a uniform distribution. Okay. And then if the numbers we generate adhere to some other probability distribution, we call them random variates. So that's just terminology. Okay. Now, random numbers are called pseudo-random because, well, basically they're not fully random. We use some algorithm to produce them. And typically these algorithms start with an initial condition which we call a seed. So if the same seed is used, then you generate the same sequence of random numbers. What we hope, again, is not knowing what the seed is and not knowing how the numbers were produced in that case, you aren't able to predict what the next number is. Okay. It's possible to get truly random sequences based on the observation of natural phenomena, so the decay of radioactive elements, etc., can give you truly random occurrences, and you can base your sequences on that. But for the purposes of simulation, it actually suits to have things which are reproducibly random. Okay. So to some extent, it's actually better, it's good for us to be able to predict the randomness. So if you start at the same point, you'll get the same result each time. Okay. So there are a number of mathematical algorithms for producing random numbers. Again, Peros describes a bunch of them. We'll look at what's essentially the simplest one, although it again gives reasonably good properties. These generators are evaluated on how closely they mimic truly random behavior. And so again, there will be a number of tests that you can carry out to determine sort of whether it reasonably adheres to any sort of distribution. We'll look at those later. For your assignment, again, you're just going to use, well, probably the Java random number generator and assume that it's good enough. Okay. So, our first step, again, is to try to produce a sequence that looks like it's drawn from the uniform 0-1 distribution. And just in case you have a brain freeze, this is the uniform 0-1 distribution. So you can work out that the average is a half and the variance is a 12th. A sequence of identically distributed uniform 0-1 variables would be expected to adhere to a number of properties. If the interval is divided into n subintervals of equal length, for a large number of observations, you would expect roughly the same number of occurrences in each subinterval. Makes sense. And again, the probability of observing a value in a particular interval is going to be independent of the previous intervals. Okay. And so, again, you'd want to test whatever generator you had against something like that. Okay. So, one of the simplest methods for generating a sequence of random numbers is the congruential method. And what this method does is it produces a recurring sequence according to the following formula, that x sub I plus 1 is axi plus c mod m. Okay. There are more generic formulas, typically. F would be some sort of linear equation, exponential equation, and then, again, take it mod M. Okay. So, in this case, we're going to generate a sequence of numbers between 0 and M minus 1. If you want to produce a range between 0 and 1, obviously you just divide by M. Okay. And what is true is that, well, this is fairly complicated mathematics, and dependent on your choices of A, C, and M, you may or may not get sort of acceptably random results. So generally, there are proven values out there that you would choose, that you would look up and use without having to test it yourself. So this gives you one set of A, C, and M that have been shown to be sort of acceptably random. Okay. So just to see what can happen, we'll look at a simple example. So we pick values of A and C to be 7 and M to be 10. We start with our initial condition of x0 is 0. And we will see if we do plug in 0 there, you get 7 mod 10 is 7. Plug in 7 there, you get 49 plus 7 is 56, mod 10 is 6. And plug in 6 there, you get 42 plus 7 is 49, mod M is 9. Plug in 9 there, you get 63 plus 7, 70, mod M is 0. And that means we're back where we started. Okay. So M is 10, but the period of our sequence is 4. So that is something that if you observe over time, it's not going to look too random. So, what characteristics does this generator have in general? Well, the period is at most M, so you have to use a big M, as we saw in our example of a tried and tested sequence. And there are a number of conditions that can be checked to ensure that the period is exactly M, okay, so that you get the maximum period possible. And so M and C must have no common divisors. A mod R must be 1 whenever R is a prime factor of M. A mod 4 must be 1 whenever M is a multiple of 4 as well. Okay, so you can check that our example doesn't fulfill those characteristics. Okay. So, this is a relatively simple generator. Again, if you want to use it, the best thing to do is to look up values that you can use that other people have already exhaustively tested. So there's one in the notes. You can come up with successively more complex generators, which may or may not be sort of give you better randomness. They usually give you longer periods anyway. Okay. In practice, probably what you're going to do is just use something that's provided for you already, for instance, Java. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so just to mention that, java.util has a random class, and it's the easiest, you'll probably find the easiest way to generate random numbers. And so, as a seed, either by default it selects the current time, the current system time, or you can specify your own seed. Again, if you want sort of reproducible results, you'd want to specify your own seed. Okay. And it gives you a number of distributions from uniform to normal and, you know, other interesting ones as well. Again, I include a reference if you want to have a look and a description of what Java specifically does. Okay. So, again, if you want to check the suitability of your output, which you might want to do either if you're producing your own or just testing what's given to you in a specific language, may or may not be good, then there's a number of tests that you can perform, which, again, what they do is they match up certain characteristics of the sequence you've generated with characteristics you'd expect if they were actually randomly generated, you know, truly randomly generated. Okay. I'm not going to say more about this now. Again, a few weeks hence, we'll discuss a few of these just in terms of, again, discussing how well data matches up to random distributions. Okay, so now we reach our final topic, which is now we have these random numbers. We're happy that they look like something that was drawn from a uniform 0-1 distribution. How do we generate sequences of numbers that look like they were drawn from other distributions? Okay. The most straightforward way that we're going to look at is what's called the inverse transform technique. And we take our sequence of random numbers and we apply to it the inverse of the cumulative distribution function. And what we'll do is we'll convince ourselves that this does look like what we want it to look like. Okay. So, suppose we have a cumulative distribution function. Capital F of X is the probability that X is less than X. Okay, and that's the CDF of the variable we want to generate. And we have a sequence of random numbers R, or let's just think of it as a random variable R, which is uniformly distributed over 0, 1. And we let fx equal r, and then t take the inverse function, so x is f inverse of r. Okay. So what we want to convince ourselves of is that if r is uniformly distributed over 0, 1, then our probability, then x equals f inverse of r is distributed according to our CDF f. Okay. So we start by saying that the probability that x is less than some value x is the probability that f inverse of r is less than x. And so then what we need to do is convince ourselves that that's equal to the probability that r is less than f of x. And so to do that, again, you know, we just applied a increasing function to it, so that should work. Okay. But now r is uniformly distributed between 0 and 1. Therefore, the probability that r is less than f of x is just f of x. Therefore, we have what we need, that we have indeed generated a variable with the appropriate distribution function. Okay. And so this sort of technique is going to be useful as long as you can find the inverse of your cumulative distribution function. So we'll look at a couple of simple examples. We'll look at the exponential distribution function, and then we'll look at the uniform distribution function over some other period range. Okay. So for an exponential distribution function, your PDF is f of x, little f of x is lambda e to the minus lambda x. The cumulative distribution function, then, you take the integral from 0 to x of little f of x, gives you 1 minus e to the minus lambda x. If I put down the mean and the variance, just for completeness sake, we don't need it at the moment. So we have our cumulative distribution function. We set r to that, so r is 1 minus e to the minus lambda x. And then we just go about solving for x. So we can remove the minus, we can isolate the x term, so e to the minus lambda x is 1 minus r. Take the log of that, you get minus lambda x is the log of 1 minus r. Okay, and divide out by the minus lambda, you get x is minus 1 over lambda, natural log 1 minus r. And then the last step is just a little tidying up. If you're going from 0 to, if r goes from 0 to 1, then 1 minus r is also uniformly distributed from 0 to 1, so it doesn't matter which one you use there. Okay. So if you wished to generate a sequence of variables that looked like they were exponentially distributed, you'd generate your sequence of variables that looks like it's uniformly distributed, And then for each of those, you'd apply this function minus 1 over lambda natural log of r.
Okay.
So, straightforward enough. You can do the same thing for a uniform distribution. So, now instead of being from zero, uniform between 0 and 1, it's uniform between A and B. So the PDF is 1 over B minus A for X between A and B. The CDF is the integral from A to X of 1 minus B over A, which gives us X minus A over B minus A. In order, again, to generate random variates of that form, we would set R equal to F of X, solve for R, solve for X, and then, so all we need to do now is we generate our sequence R1, R2, R3, R4, and apply this formula to get X1, X2, X3, X4, where those, again, are distributed uniform over A, B. Okay, so that will work for a lot of sort of pretty basic distributions. In order to apply it, you have to be able to define the CDF, and you have to be able to take the inverse of the CDF. Now, there are a number of distributions for which that might or might not be that easy to do, and so we'll take a look at a couple of those and how you can generate random variates for those. Okay. So the Erlang K distribution represents the sum of K IID exponential random variables. And so just as an interpretation, this might be the time it takes to do a series of jobs, so one after the other, after the other, after the other, so where each, the time it takes to take any one job is exponentially distributed. Okay. Well, we already know how to generate exponential random variates, so our sequence, which has that sort of a distribution. So the easiest way to produce an Erlang K is just to take the sum of k of our exponential variates, which we've already produced. Okay. Now, another common distribution for which we can't really write down a CDF is the normal distribution. And we'll be seeing this a fair amount. It's fairly important for what we do. And so the probability density function for a normal distribution with expectation mu and variance sigma squared is f of x equals 1 over sigma square root of 2 pi e to the minus 1/2 x minus mu squared over sigma squared. Okay. And so, again, this is a fairly common distribution, but you can't analytically solve for the cumulative distribution function. So we can't apply our first technique. So what we do, again, is sort of a trick. We generate something that looks normal and set it equal to what we have initially. So what we want is this x is normal mu sigma squared. Well, if x is normal mu sigma squared, then we can produce a z equals x minus mu over sigma, which is normal 0, 1, with a mean of 0 and a variance of 1. Okay, so essentially the mu here is moving the mean, and the sigma is changing the width of that curve to a normalized value. Okay. The only reason to again do that normalization is so that we can have a fixed point of reference to deal with. Okay. What we can do now is produce a random variate which is normal 0, 1. To do this, we use the central limit theorem. And what the central limit theorem says is that if we have a sequence of IID random variables, each with mean mu and variance sigma squared, then their sum approaches a normal distribution with mean k mu and variance k sigma squared. And that's it. So if you sum up enough of these, they start looking normal. Okay. Excuse me. So what we can do is sum up k of our random numbers. So our random numbers are uniform 0, 1. If we sum up enough of them, again, it's going to start looking normal. For each individual, the mean is a half, so the overall mean is k over 2. And the variance is 1/12, so the overall variance is k over 12. Okay. And so we can produce this. And we also know that if we adjust its mean and variance, we have something that's normal 0, 1. So we have two variables now, two quantities, which were normal 0, 1, so we can equate the two. One's our sum of random numbers adjusted by its mean and variance. The other one is what we're looking for, adjusted by mu and sigma. And finally, we can solve now for x. And what we get is x as a sum of our initial random numbers. Okay. Okay. The only discrete distribution I'm going to mention is the Poisson process model. Questions back there? Okay. And a Poisson process model models the number of occurrences of an event over a period of time. And so, again, it's a discrete distribution. You get the probability of having n occurrences in a period of time. Excuse me. Okay. And, again, the trick is to recognize that the time that lapses between two successive occurrences of an event is exponentially distributed with mean 1 over lambda. Over lambda is the term here. Excuse me. Okay. So again, what we observe is that we already know how to generate exponential variance with this mean, or with any mean. And so to determine what n is, what we do is we sum the variance until the sum exceeds 1. So you just keep adding up until you've hit your time frame, and however many you counted there will give you your Poisson distribution. Excuse me. Okay. So our final comment is on empirical probability distributions. And here what we're doing is we're modeling our distributions based on actual data. And so in the first case, we might have a discrete probability distribution. And you can work, if you're just observing the data, you can work out the distribution based on the number of occurrences of any particular value. And so here we start with, we work out the probability that x equals I is pi. And so to take the inverse of that, so if you want to be in this range, you know that your random variance should be between P1 and P2. And so as long as you're in that range, you assign x the value of I. Okay. If we're trying to come up with a continuous probability distribution, well, we've only got a finite number of observations. And so typically what you'll do is you'll turn that into a histogram. So you'll choose ranges and assign probabilities that your values are in any given range. The smaller you choose the ranges, the closer it comes to the actual curve. And what this will give you is a piecewise linear CDF, which again we can use our inverse transform technique then on any piece of that CDF. Okay, so that's it for today. The major things to think about are, again, what are the main components of a simulation model, a discrete event simulation model? What will you need to specify or represent in order to generate such a model? And so, again, the big components are the event list, the clocks, and the event logic. And so we've then had a little look at how possibly you can generate event lists and how you can generate clock values. Okay. some of what we discussed was sort of very basic, and again, if you're running a Java implementation, Java will have done some of it for you, and you won't necessarily start from scratch. So what we will continue with next week is, again, trying to get how do we get some useful information? We've got this model, and it's generating one sequence out of the infinite number of sequences that could possibly be generated. Or if you run it multiple times, you'll get a number of sequences out of the infinite number of sequences that could possibly be generated. And so what we'll look at next time is how can we get some sort of general information about the system, which in some way is meaningful from this very small number of observations of system behavior. Okay, so have a good weekend. I will see you guys next week.
Thank you.